How do we work with a client's rigid beliefs? I'm talking about beyond just resistance. These are clients who've developed a specific framework for how the world works. Here, Dr. Kelly McGonigal shows how to open clients up to new perspectives by making this one key change in ourselves.
The other category of resistance that I encounter a lot has to do with really wanting to cling to a worldview. And in part, that's because a lot of the work that I do is asking people to change their mindset, whether it's cultivating greater compassion or self-compassion and empathy, or whether it's changing the way that they relate to stress and difficult experiences. And, it makes a lot of sense why we would have resistance when we're asked to change our mind, because part of how we function in the world is we maintain a perspective on how the world works, who I am, what my role is, what I want to experience and what I don't want to experience. If we didn't have that kind of mindset or framework, it'd be really hard to just navigate our experiences. And yet at the same time, we know that most growth and most transformation requires beginning to open to new ideas and new ways of thinking about others and ourselves and the way that the world works. And I have found that in working with this resistance, I have very much had to change my own relationship to it. And part of that is coming to understand that working with your own resistance is necessary to the process of transformation. That someone who, as someone as a teacher or as a guide or as a coach, sort of whatever that relationship is, if I say, by the way, did you know that actually you might think of compassion as a weakness, but it actually can be a strength, and someone agrees with me immediately, that might feel really good in that moment. Like, oh, gee, Kelly, I never thought of it that way before. I think you're right. It might feel good, but that is not transformation actually happening. That might be bypass, people wanting to accomplish some sort of transformation without actually having to go through the process. So I've had to learn to recognize that if I'm not experiencing pushback from people, I'm probably not on the right path. And for every sort of type of content or theory that I teach, I've learned to recognize very familiar forms of resistance that will show up. And so now I get a sort of inner delight, like, oh, okay, I know that resistance. That resistance is about not wanting to believe that bad things can happen to good people. Or that particular resistance is sort of a deep belief that who you are is wrong and needs to be controlled, and a fear about what it would mean if you gave up that belief. I know that one. I've seen that before. And to have my own relationship with these different kinds of resistance where I can welcome it, I can help people explore it, and feel as though that is the work rather than that is the barrier to the work that I'm trying to do. This is something that I often, I train facilitators of our compassion cultivation training program, and often teachers have this experience too, group facilitators. They want groups to go really well. They want sessions to go really well. And by that, they mean they want it to kind of feel good while they're doing it. And what I found is that actually you need to be willing to be really uncomfortable, to be challenged, to make room for all the emotions that come up when people are experiencing this flavor of resistance. Because if that's not happening, you are not actually creating the context for transformation to unfold. And I'll just give you an example of a recent compassion class that I was teaching with physicians. And, wow, this group of physicians, there was a lot of resistance to the idea of self-compassion. And one of the physicians, she was talking about why it felt so scary to contemplate having compassion for herself. And she said, I'm okay with this idea of, compassion, sometimes, but unconditional compassion, I am not okay with. There's something not acceptable about unconditional compassion. And I recognize that resistance. And so we just had a conversation. I said, okay, so what conditions would you like to place on your compassion? And she was really surprised by that question. Instead of a debate like, well, you're wrong, you need to have self-compassion, so we really explore it. She's like, what do you mean? What conditions do I want to put on compassion? Well, you just said you didn't want unconditional compassion. So let's think about what conditions you would like to put on your compassion that would make it feel safe, that would make it feel acceptable. And it was so interesting. What came forward then was really revealing not the energy of the resistance, which you can get stuck engaging with, like you want to argue with it or you want to push it away. But it actually started to reveal the real content of the resistance. She said that compassion needed to have standards. So that was interesting. Like, well, what kind of standards? And what do you think compassion's normal relationship to standards are? And really starting to explore beliefs that were present and assumptions that were present. And in my experience, that's the only way to work with resistance, that you start to chip away, well, what beliefs are present right now? What assumptions are present right now? Just sort of put them on the table. And people often will navigate their own way through those, because almost always what they're bringing forward are actually seeds of suffering. And if you open the space for people to start to identify that themselves, you don't need to argue as much as you need to just sort of spread it out on the table. What is it like when you're operating from the assumption that, and then whatever sort of was behind that resistance?
How did that turn out with her?
We had many conversations about it, but what I sense, in that particular session was a real, like what you actually often see with people when the process of resistance is working, is they actually become quiet, and that you see there's an embodiment of opening that can happen where people, it's almost like you lean in when you're arguing. What you actually see is people sit back, right? Their gaze might lift, and there's some kind of softening as well as a silencing. And, I remember very clearly observing that in that particular conversation. And then, I know from continued conversations that the idea of acknowledging and taking care of her own suffering is something that she did open to more, and actually the entire class opened to more. And it was really important that she name that resistance too, because it gave other people permission to recognize and name it. It even gave me permission to recognize and name it. After that particular conversation, I remember finding it easier to see how I myself was engaging in sort of subtle ways of not practicing self-care because of the belief that other people were depending on me. And it wasn't identical to what her resistance was, but because we'd engaged with that in a particular way, I was able to see my own beliefs and perspectives that were getting in the way of practicing self-compassion.
Kelly showed how this type of work can have a kind of boomerang effect, allowing Kelly to recognize her own areas of resistance. For some further thoughts on working with rigid beliefs, let's visit now with Dr. Ron Siegel and Bill O'Hanlon.
I find curiosity is enormously helpful. And just the question of, well, when did you first start thinking that way? Or when did you first start seeing it that way or believing that? Simply asking that question starts to set it up as, oh, you mean this is a point of view rather than simply reality that we're all marinated in? And, just talking about that starts to loosen it. And then that can be followed by zeroing in on the feelings that are associated with not living in accordance to the worldview. So that, for example, if it's, the worldview about, oh, I've got to be a winner in some realm or another. So what does it feel like to be a loser? What does it feel like when the disappointment happens? What does it feel like when it doesn't work out? Or for the person who needs to see themselves as moral, what does it feel like when you feel like you haven't been such a good person? Or the person who's, uncomfortable with their sexuality or aggression, what does it feel like when you see yourself as, having the wrong kind of sexual feeling or being too aggressive or not being aggressive enough, whatever it might be? And so often if a person comes into contact with the emotion associated with the worldview, that leads to associations that unravel it. We start to see how the worldview got laid down. And there's usually a whole series of usually painful incidents that happened where I felt like I wasn't doing what I should do vis-a-vis that worldview. And this can be very, very helpful.
I have two methods or techniques, I guess, that I use for this. And one is the simple question, Can you remember a time when you believed something firmly held that is true, and then you changed? You know, life changed, you changed, you went through another experience. And, you know, I'll give an example of mine. I used to consider myself shy. I just didn't think I could talk in front of people. And here I am talking in front of you all. And I became a public speaker. And if you would have asked me during that time when I believed that I was shy and I couldn't talk in front of a group of people, I would have told you were crazy. That was just not possible. And then years later, it seemed like, why was I so adamant about that? I do it all the time now. It's not that hard. And once I got over that fear. So I'm sure most people have an example like that in their life. So this first thing is, tell me about a time when you used to have a point of view and then you changed it. Almost everybody has that. The second one is one I borrowed from narrative therapy. It's externalization. So what is that belief telling you right now? Does that, you know, what is that fear telling you right now? You know, because usually this stuff comes out of fear, as we've heard. And do you believe it? And is it, what does it promise you? What does that belief promise you it will do? Protect you or make you happier or whatever? And is it working? Is it delivering the promise? So that externalizing that belief, so it's not you. When you become identified with the belief, it's really hard to change, because then anytime we try and change it, we're trying to change you or attack you, and you have to defend it. But if it's out there, a little distant from you, it's a little easier to take a look at objectively and maybe give up or change or alter it somewhat.
As Bill said, an important first step is creating some distance between the client and the belief. In the next bonus, we'll look at ways to work with a willful client. I'll see you there.